Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special bonus edition of Ultra 64 / Wii Universe / whatever the hell you want to call it. All you need to know is that it's special. We're here with a guest. We're very excited about it. And I am the disembodied voice of Steve Guntley.
Hi. Suffering from psychosis, I'm Woody Soskowski.
You know, I had a suspicion, but how's that feeling today?
You know, it comes and goes.
Comes and goes. Yeah, no, that's fair. That's totally
like
fair.
This for everything, turn.
We are joined by a very special guest today. He's one of our high-level patrons on patreon.com/ultra64pod. As you know, people who support us at that tier get to join us on air and talk about any game of their choosing. And our guest today is CJ Baker. Welcome.
Spooky new voice inside your head, CJ Baker, and this is what I sound like.
You got a great great public radio voice there, CJ.
You really do. Yeah, you really do.
You're just listening my shattered hopes and dreams. Thanks. You know what? It's really on brand and really on theme. Thanks for bringing up a painful memory.
Well, painful memories might be the theme of this conversation in
general.
It might be.
Because, yeah, there's this game brings up quite a few of them.
Yeah, you picked a game that is no light jaunt, I would say. It is kind of a walk in the woods.
It
but
is.
Not like a friendly, happy animals cartoon walk.
Yeah.
More of like a dark, ominous.
A dark,
dismal. Yeah. But look, we'll unpack that as we get into it, I guess. Let's not. Welcome to Depression Cast.
Yeah, basically, There's going to be a bit of that.
I mean, when you break it down, every podcast is kind of Depression Cast.
It basically
based on
is.
The sort of people who put them together.
Every one of us is a failed, gifted child from our youth.
I mean, that may be the secret of the Joe Rogan success, right? He's the only one who actually seems to, like, be confident about his place in the world.
Oh, I hate it. I hate it. It's not fair.
This is not the Joe Rogan this. There's been a mistake.
Look, we're
going to try and get you to drink donkey semen by the end of the episode, so don't worry about that. We're every bit as good as Rogan in that front.
In the donkey semen front.
On the donkey semen front, if you else.
I've come to the right place.
So the game that CJ has chosen for us today is called Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice. There's so much to talk about with this very, very cool, very dark game. CJ, I wanted to ask you before we get started, why did you want to talk about this game? Of all the games in the universe, you wanted to talk about Hellblade.
of everything that I could have picked, I think one of the things that's possibly a reflex when being allowed to roll the dice for another human is to give them something horrible to do. And as much as I didn't really want to do that, I kind of wanted to give you guys something to pull down and something to do the research on that was a pretty challenging experience, but also a really good example of a studio and a team punching really at the top of their game.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a hugely ambitious game, and I'm excited to be digging into a little bit about Ninja Theory, because I think they're a really exciting and interesting developer, and they're kind of taking things in a lot of unusual. You never really know which way this company is going to go, and so it's always very exciting to watch them.
This game is interesting because I feel like it exists in the cross sections of a lot of different, I don't know, what the crossroads, crosshairs.
Sure. Yeah.
What's a thing that comes to a cross section that doesn't have the word cross in it?
Damn it. Wow. Yeah. We are with it today. Wow. We are with it.
It is such a great...
Clearly not my synapses.
There, Woody, it's such a good multidisciplinary kind of piece of art.
You know, yes.
It's both technically really impressive. These folks squeezed a great deal out of the Unreal Engine. So I'm really excited to see what they do with UE5 in their hands. But also just they've really brought together both artistic direction through camera work and facial capture technology, body capture technology that they started way back with Heavenly Sword, Steve, was their first big employment of that tech. But as far as a game goes, Senua's Sacrifice is almost an anti-game. You know, there's no level progression. There isn't a crafting system.
There's no on-screen instructions. Yeah,
and nope. There's no minimap.
There's no open world. The world is very unopen.
Very closed. Very closed world.
Isn't it? It's such a crafted experience when so much else of what we play is so open and is just an almost a checklist of things to go and do, whereas this experience takes that concept of what gamifying is,
yeah,
and just throws it the fuck away.
Which
and says, actually, here's what we're here to serve up.
I was excited that you chose this game because I have never played it before, but I've always looked at it and thought,
oh, wow,
oh, that seems really neat. That seems right up my alley. As you kind of hinted at, like, this game looks absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Like, you look at the screenshots and the character models and you're like, wow, this game is just blows my head off in terms of design. And it looks like it's going to be an action game.
Yeah.
Like, it is by a company called Ninja Theory that made the the game that
made
they,
action games.
You've
yeah.
made
yeah.
action games in the past, and you see screenshots of Senua, running around with this cool sword and this very smooth flowing combat. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I was really excited, and then I was surprised when my initial assumptions about this game were quite inaccurate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were a little bit. Yeah, yeah.
But I can't imagine that I'm alone in that. And that's why I do think that this game is really worth talking about, because it's really important to know what this, in some regards, what this game is before
in
you
decide.
Before
right.
you decide,
you give the whole thing.
Yeah,
away.
And more important, what it isn't. Yeah, it's
yeah.
good
because
to know what this game is not.
I am not sure that this is a game for me.
Right.
I think that this game mm-hmm. does a lot of things that I find frustrating and not pleasurable. And I don't mm-hmm. necessarily mean that thematically,
mm.
but there were a couple times with puzzles where I was stuck and frustrated. And when I finally found the solution, I was equally frustrated because the solution seemed so arbitrary to me.
There's a lot to get into with it. Like, I think an interesting, so this game is billed as kind of an independent AAA. That's sort of the branding that Ninja Theory was going for with this, which is they wanted the presentation of a AAA game, but with like a smaller focus and kind of the more basic mechanics of an indie game.
Did this game even get a physical release?
It did eventually. It got a Game of the Year release like about a year later.
And that's sort of the first little crossroads that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Is like, this game, when you think of games that get digital-only releases, you think of like mm-hmm. small-scale, like, retro throwback graphics, like something that's going to be
Bit Trip Runner, things like
that. Yeah, exactly.
Undertale.
Yeah.
Spelunky. Like, all these things are great, but they have a very specific world that they live in. And when you think of a game that looks like this, I mean, just this game looks very similar to God of War, like new God of War.
Actually, the one I was thinking of is Horizon, a game that came out around a similar time as this, has kind of a similar character model for the main character. And I feel like that's kind of the difference. You're taking these similar elements, and one is like an open world game with crafting and hunting and all these different complex things, and this is a very focused narrative.
But my point is, like,
very few robot dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Senua's Sacrifice.
You know what? And I'm pissed about
didn't
that
find
still.
Them.
Yeah, you didn't
the
look hard enough.
Sequel's underway. You can get them.
But it's like the graphical production of something like Horizon or God of War, you just don't expect to see in a $40 downloadable only game.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that lends it another sort of weird mid space.
I remember being a very big dork and like going to buy this game day one at a GameStop only to have them tell me, oh, that one's only downloadable. Because I saw images of it and I'm like, well, this must be a physical disc. This is clearly like a major release, like with like they're pushing technology forward. This is a company I know and love. Like, there clearly must be a physical release.
Why would
release.
I not have a thing that I could put on my shelf?
Right, exactly. That's all I wanted, and they didn't have one for me. Let's dig in a little bit and talk about this game and about its developer. So Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice was released August 8th, 2017. It was developed and published by Ninja Theory, and it has been released on PS4, Xbox One, Windows, Switch, and Series X/S. All right, so Ninja Theory, a company with a very fascinating history, I think. This company is kind of marked by multiple significant reinventions, and they've spent most of their existence kind of on the cusp of total bankruptcy. But they've got a whole lot of ambition and a whole lot of talent, and I think they managed to attract big-name investors even when those don't really pay off. So the company was founded in 2001 in Cambridge, England, originally known as Just Add Monsters, which is a pretty good game development title for 2001.
It's a good pub quiz team name.
Oh, that would be, actually. Yeah, I have to keep that one in mind. Originally, the team only had 3 members, and they were all working out of their shared apartment with only a 3,000-pound budget. They were able to sell their pitch for a Kung Fu-based party game called Kung Fu Chaos, which was distributed by Argonaut Software and released on the Xbox in 2003. You might vaguely remember the cover art from that if you've seen it around. Like, I don't know. I always get it confused with Freaky Flyers, even though it's not a racing game. I just know one of them is, like, super racist, and I think it's Freaky Flyers.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just trying to remember.
The other one.
Which one is the racist one?
Racist.
Yeah, this one's probably a little racist, but it's also mostly, like, animals. Freaky Flyers is, like, horrible, like, website propaganda. Horrible. Really bad. Huh.
All right, so we've come down as anti-Freaky Flyers.
Anti-Freaky
on this
Flyers. I'm saying it. Okay, so while they were at Argonaut, they began working on a new game called Kung Fu Story, which was later renamed Heavenly Sword. Mm. So after Kung Fu Chaos sold poorly, they had no more money left, and so Just Add Monsters was acquired by Argonaut. But then a few years later, Argonaut shut down, and the original team at Just Add Monsters was able to buy back their company and buy the rights to Heavenly Sword so they could continue working on it. They renamed themselves as Ninja Theory to kind of reflect the more serious direction they wanted their games to go.
Though I don't know if Ninja Theory connotes a serious direction.
But it doesn't connote wackiness, which I think Just Add Monsters...
I disagree.
Sounds like an 80s like cartoon.
I think also Ninja Theory sounds as like an 80s cartoon. It's like he's like an atomic scientist by day, and by night he like cat burgles the local museum.
Yeah, so they began working on Heavenly Sword, and they started running out of money and resources pretty quickly, but they were bailed out at the last minute when Sony stepped in and agreed to bankroll the games, hoping to parlay it into a much-needed platform exclusive for the PS3.
Yeah, I do remember that. Like, I've never played Heavenly Sword. It's got, you know, a beautiful, beautiful piece of cover art that I feel like we do remember. But
I feel like the cover art's burned into anyone that was, you know, a young guy between sort of 14 and 18 when the PS3 launch came out. Now, Steve, was this at the tail end of that kind of dreadful launch cycle? Was this one of the games that
the
PS3 back up again?
This was, yeah. This was initially, I think it was meant to be a launch game, and it wound up getting pushed because Sony saw the potential in it. They invested like $20 million to beef up the production, and then so that pushed it for a little bit. So it was supposed to be out in the early crop with like Layer and games like
that. It is so odd the way that kind of got flipped on its head. Like, if you, in retrospect, like the PS3 seems like such a more well-developed, like, system with a variety of games than the 360 did terms of like exclusives, but sort of in that early going it felt like there was nothing on the PS3 and the 360 was getting everything.
That PS3 is one of the worst launches of any system. Like, it's just, there was like nothing worthwhile really. But you know, Sony had big ambitions for this one. They contracted out to Peter Jackson's special effects company Weta. I don't know how it's pronounced. WETA. And they brought in Andy Serkis, who came in and provided some consultations for the mocap performances, and I think is cited as a creative director on that game.
Oh, that's cool.
So that game came out in 2007. I've actually never played this one either. This is the only one of their games I've never played. I hear it's good.
I'm sure it's good. I mean, by looking at the screenshots and the game in action, I feel like it just kind of plays like God of War, right?
Sure.
Like your PS2 God of War. That's just what it looks like.
Yeah.
Or slightly worse Ninja Gaiden.
And you can't jump. I know that was a big thing that people were complaining about in that game. Okay. But like, you don't have to jump in every game. I don't know what to tell you. Yeah, so that came out in 2007. You know, and it sold more than 1 million units. But by that point, production costs had been driven up so much that 1 million units really wasn't going to get them to break even. So they kind of abandoned the future franchise plans they had for Heavenly Sword. But either way, Sony felt pretty encouraged by Ninja Theory's potential, and they agreed to help fund their next game, which was Enslaved: Odyssey to the West, which is it's a sci-fi adaptation of a Chinese folktale. It was
Does it involve monkey kings of some kind?
It sure does. It absolutely does. Your main character's name is Monkey, and he's played by Andy Serkis in voice and body. Alex Garland wrote the script to this game.
He really, really got typecast there with the Planet of the Apes stuff.
King Kong
a little bit here. And was Circus?
He was Peter Jackson's King Kong. Yeah.
So This was a real touch point for Australians. Monkey magic, does that mean anything to you guys? Does that have any cultural touchstone at all? I mean, the blank faces are saying a lot.
No, so I don't know this.
There is, here we go, guys. I'll set you on a bit of a journey to search. a journey to the West. So it was a fantastic Journey to the West adaptation that became a cult watch here in Australia. There's 2 seasons, I think. It's out there on DVD somewhere.
Oh, okay.
It's just called Monkey, but colloquially Monkey Magic. This is the kind of thing that you would, as a young sort of 16 to 20 year old, you could go out on the town and drink a goon bag in the back of someone's ute before going to some bash where there's perhaps some Sheilas, and then you drag yourself home at about 2 in the morning and watch a program called Rage, when Australia has a very lax relationship with television, so we didn't have MTV.
I thought you were going to say Australia has a lax relationship with Rage.
So Rage was just wall-to-wall music videos.
Okay.
With, you know, sometimes they would like drag Soundgarden on to do some programming for them. But you would watch Rage to pretend you were still partying, so you had a reason to continue drinking.
Okay.
And that would then segue into Monkey at about 6 in the morning, which would then play in about a 2-hour block. So you had a good reflective couple of hours with a Journey to the West story that would let you consider again if you wanted to keep drinking into Sunday or if you had to start sobering up for work on Monday. But if you're after... If you've got any kind of affection for that sort of story and 70s produced dubbed kung fu stories made without a budget in 80s Japan, it's totally a good way to go.
We do have amazing. An interest in that.
Yeah, we do. Absolutely.
Also,
yeah.
I just want the rest of this podcast to be CJ talking it with Australian colloquialisms.
I'm learning so many. Yeah. I was trying to think of some like Colorado ones I could throw out that people would be stumped by, but I don't know if we have any good ones.
Grouse.
Grouse? Okay. What's grouse? Is that just complaining or is that the bird?
I think that's that means good. Question mark?
Oh,
it's a thing. People generally about 20 years older than myself get into conversation.
You're learning very so cool. much about your home state.
This is great. I'm learning. Okay. So a little bit more about Enslaved. Like I said, this game was written by Alex Garland, who would go on to write Ex Machina and Annihilation. He'd already written 28 Days Later.
Way.
Excellent screenwriter. Good director. And they partnered up with Andy Serkis again to play Monkey and. That game completely rules. I don't know if anyone else has played that game. That game fucking slaps. It is so good. I played through it like maybe 3 times. I've got 100% trophies on it. I love that game. It's one of the best acted games of that generation.
No one likes a Brago.
Definitely check it out. Definitely check it out. No one likes me. It's okay.
It's very... That game has a confusing space, much the way that I think Senua does.
Yeah.
In that... It's very hard to tell what that game is.
It is.
Based on any aspect of the box art or marketing or title.
No, that's...
I thought that game was an RPG.
It is not. It is okay. It's like an action game. It's like an action, third-party action game.
Third-person
action game. And it's really, really good. It's really definitely worth checking out. And it's probably very cheap right now because this game sold very, very poorly because of the aforementioned problems of people not knowing what the fuck this game is. And also a title like Enslaved does not really sound fun to play. Like it doesn't sound like a...
It is a tough sell.
Yeah, I mean, even just calling it Odyssey to the West would have made a little more sense. You know, the original story is Journey to the West, I think, right?
And then that sounds right.
Stephen Chow made a movie of it as well not too long ago. But either way, once again, the game did not sell well, but it's still the quality of it still attracted some more attention. And so Ninja Theory was hired on for their next game by Capcom, this time looking to revamp their classic series Devil May Cry. So DMC was their take on the character, the DMC Devil May Cry. And this is a pretty radically different take on Dante, the character from the series. He was younger. He's got like goth black hair. He's kind of a wise ass. And
listens to a lot of corn.
Yeah, he listens to a lot of corn. He does look very like emo rock star, like, of the mid-2000s. That's kind of his new look.
Got a real Chris Angel vibe.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, I think it's more Chris Angel than anything else. Yeah, I think that's really true.
So I've always been curious about this, because I know that people were not necessarily crazy about this redesign. But my question is, how is that different than regular Dante?
How is it different? Exactly. He has dark hair instead of light hair. It's like
he's kind of a wise ass.
He's kind of a wise ass. He kills things with a sword and a gun combination. Like, I think...
a real stretch, is it?
I actually think that game is really good. Like, I've played it. It's like a four-hour-long game. It's great. You'll just blast right through it. I really enjoyed it. But fans at the time were furious about this redesign, to the point where executives at Ninja Theory were getting death threats at their homes.
I mean, to be clear, in the world we live in, it does not take much to get a death threat.
It really doesn't. But still, come on, guys, get it together. It really didn't hurt you that much.
Everyone's got to raise their death threat barometer.
Like, yeah, seriously.
Just if you're. Here's a tip for all of our listeners there writing a death threat right now or planning to write one tomorrow.
Just stop it.
Just stop it. Take a deep breath and be like, does this really warrant my energy? Is this going to improve the person's life when they receive it? No.
Have you tried a cup of tea?
Cup of tea.
Have a nice cup of tea. Calm down.
Maybe play some Enslaved Journey to the West.
Do that. It's great. It's really fun. either way, despite all of the hatred from fans, DMC proved to be the company's first actual honest-to-God hit. It sold about 4 million copies.
It was clear what that game was what it was based on, and you're like, okay, you play as Dante and you slash things.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's like that marketing cut through. It's like, okay, you know, I'm getting kind of tired of Devil May Cry at this point. It's sort of been the same game 4 times in a row now. Let's mix it up. And this game mixed it up, and it was fun, and it still kind of kept everything that worked about the series. But yeah, it sold well, and the company used this new windfall to kind of reevaluate what they were doing as a company. They dabbled a little bit in mobile games while they were figuring it out, kind of offered themselves as consultants on other projects, and finally they decided on their new direction as an independent publisher, and that's where they came up with the independent AAA title, where they just wanted their projects to be as polished as possible and reach a wide market while still being relatively cost-effective and with a small team. So yeah, Hellblade was Ninja Theory's first project under this new branding. So it was developed over the course of 3 years. They had a team of only 15 people made this game.
Wow.
But despite the small size, Ninja Theory invested heavily in the game, and they founded an in-house division called Senua Studios, which was built specifically to develop new motion capture technology. So they really kind of were pushing that forward here. Since the team had a very strong focus, or the game had a very strong focus on mental illness, so they wanted to bring in neuroscientists and psychiatrists to come in and consult and get the conditions that they were reflecting as accurately as possible.
Now, my question is, do you think, I don't know if you know this or not, but do you think that was a starting point for this game, or it was something that they came up with the premise for this game first and kind of decided to inject that into it?
It was kind of that. So they were toying with the idea of kind of making it a little more opaque and just kind of suggesting that the things you're seeing are in Senua's mind.
Okay.
And then I think as they were developing it, they realized it would be more interesting if they were more explicit about that and to kind of make her mental health struggles the focus, you know.
Okay.
And that really kind of redefined the direction this game went, I think, because it would have been a pretty generic hack and slash game, I think, without that extra kind of
hack and slash slash looking at things simulator.
Slash looking at stuff. Yeah.
Rune identifying and simulator.
And it really, I think you're right there, Steve. It there's a lot of self-published content that Ninja Theory put out there that I'm sure you came across in your research as well. And there's that great featurette that's included with the game on completion. But you see some of the stages that they went through, and you can see that from early development, they had the concept and the visual style and the kind of art direction they were looking for. And then it speaks, I think, to the sort of the creative team and the creative directors that when they hit a point like that where they need to look at representation within the thing that they're creating, that they pulled in all the right experts. And the something you sort of alluded to earlier, Woody, this game is it will intentionally confuse and frustrate you. and that's kind of meta. It will give people a tiny taste almost of what this that living with psychosis might be like for people.
Yeah, and I think that's the really successful thing about this. And this new direction allowed them, they were able to secure some grant funding from some mental health charities in the UK, because they realized, like, okay, this is an important kind of piece of art that you're putting out that'll bring awareness to some of these conditions.
And that's sort of something I was thinking about a little bit as I played this. I'm like, you know, this game isn't doing much for me from a gameplay standpoint, and I think it might be more successful, you know, as a movie, but then I sort of thought more about those elements of sort of the psychosis and things like that. And it really does create a very empathetic picture by having you play as someone suffering from these conditions of, like, the game tells you right at the beginning, like, you should play this game with headphones.
Yes.
And
what a difference that makes.
It does make a huge difference, because to me, and everyone's experience is different, so I don't necessarily, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but when I find myself in periods of either depression or anxiety, what sort of comes back is incessant dog barking that I just hear in my head. Hold on, we're going to take a very quick breather. Okay, great. What I most associate with those sort of mental states is kind of an incessant mental chatter that you cannot escape from your head. And there's never a sense of, like, getting out of your own head. And that is at its core.
And finding that pace.
Yeah, that is at the core what these headphones do when you play this game. You're just walking around fighting. You fight an enemy or you try to solve a puzzle, and there just becomes this chatter. The game doesn't explain what it is initially. Like, I thought maybe these were kind of like the fates or something watching over Senua, who are going to, like, be commenting on her stuff. But it's like, oh, actually, this is sort of the chatter on in her head, sometimes first person perspective, sometimes third person, of, like, she won't find a way through the bridge. She can't do it. It's too hard.
And sometimes they'll be encouraging you, and sometimes they'll be giving you, like, counterintuitive, like, they'll be canceling each other out, you know?
And it is a very well done artistic effect, in the sense that it contributes to the theme. It really does make you feel that sort of anxiety, and also in this or shame or fear. Also in that sense, you get pretty tired of it.
Yeah.
Just in the same way you get tired of your mental chatter in your own head.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, I just want this to stop. And they even integrate it into such a way as, like, if you get lost, like I did, or have trouble finding solutions to puzzles, they will kind of point you to the right direction. There's one where they're like, follow the screaming. The screaming will help you see the rune that you're trying to see. And it's...
Yes, Woody. Go towards the
screaming. Go towards the screaming. Exactly. Always a good life tip. But what all that contributes to is, this game is essentially an exercise in minimalism.
Yeah.
Like, there's no... I think that this game is kind of like a smoke and mirrors trick, because obviously the graphics and production values of this game look great. And the sort of mental chatter that goes on in your headphones is very effective, and they serve to cover up the fact that there's really not very much to this game. Like, it's essentially a series of...
It is certainly pared down.
It's essentially a series of corridors that, you know, they're outside, they look amazing, but, like, the environments themselves don't change very much. There's only about 3 to 5 different enemies that you fight over the course of the whole game.
Yeah.
And then there's Senua and one other character that she talks to.
Yeah.
And you don't really notice these things while you're playing it, unless you're thinking about it in, like, a very critical way, because the game does such an effective job of looking like this total AAA title and, you know, having such good production values. But
And so you're expecting something like, you know, looking for, I mean, I guess there are, like, little collectibles, like in the lore stones, like you can find all the different,
but they're not collectibles.
They're not
really
collectibles.
They're just a stone that you look at and talks at you.
Yeah. They're
flavor,
but there's no inventory in this game.
No,
there's
inventory.
No life bar.
There's no HUD. There's no anything. There's no, tutorials when you're getting into the game.
It's no robot dinosaurs.
Zero robot dinosaurs.
There's no annoying fairy pixie when you reach puberty that tells you to listen. Hey, look at stuff. Listen.
Listen.
So a little bit about the story here, just so we can kind of set the scene. So this takes place in the 8th century, And Senua is a woman from the Orkney Islands. She's like a Pict warrior. I had to look this up. I don't really know who the Picts were or when they were from, but she's a Pict warrior from the 8th century. She's traveled from the Orkney Islands north of Scotland to they don't specify. They imply it's like Norway, but they just say to the Northlands.
The whole premise is based on North mythology, which again scratches very much the same itch that God of War does.
And it's also kind of important that like it's Senua's dealing with mythology that isn't from her own culture. So it's supposed to feel like very alien to her. So she has set out to the Northlands because her boyfriend or lover, whatever we would call him, a guy named Dillion.
Sounds like Liam Neeson.
Sounds a lot like Liam Neeson.
Pictman?
A Pictman. He's a Pictman. You got to whistle and he'll come at you.
Out.
So you have to go and dig out your boyfriend who's buried in the ground.
I mean, he'd be pretty easy to pick up the way she's carrying him around for most of it. But yeah. But so Dillion has been killed. We're not sure how, but it's implied that it has something to do with Senua. And so she is trying to go literally into hell to go back and save her boyfriend and bring him back.
It's the same Orpheus and Eurydice thing. Just in a different set mythology.
So when she arrives on this island, she needs to cross the gates of hell, which means in order to do that, she needs to go and defeat the two lieutenants of Hela. And that's Valravn, who is the master of illusion, and Surt, who is the master of fire. And so you have to fight in those two channels. So that's kind of the basic story. I like this for a lot of reasons. Firstly, this is a world we've never really seen up to this point. I mean, I think God of War would eventually kind of put a similar spin on a similar
era. Did this game come out pre God of War?
This did. This came out about a year before.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of getting into a time. I also, you know, and so it's also important to note that Senua is schizophrenic. Now she obviously hasn't been diagnosed as such because psychiatry won't be invented for another 1,000 years or so. But this raises some
she's
really
got ghosts in her blood.
This raises some really interesting questions about
some holes in the head for it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how would this condition be perceived in this time, both from the person suffering it and the people witnessing it, you know? And so, of course, they assume she's been cursed. She has a curse in her blood. There's something wrong with her. She hears ghosts. She hears whispers. And so you really feel the weight of that this time. Like, it feels extra hopeless.
It's so effective in setting that scene and I guess showing you her experience, not just telling you. There's not simply a cut scene where you see Senua being ostracized.
No,
the camera and the modeling is used in such a way that you are shown that you experience that.
And some of the times when we do get her backstory, we are put in a position of someone judging her. Like, she is imploring to the camera. Like, there's a scene she's talking to her father, and her father's refusing to let her get help because she's cursed. And the game puts us into his eyes. Like, we're the one watching her. And it's really effective. Now, we've talked a little bit about some of the presentation. This is all presented two ways. Of course, the audio, which we've talked about. And this is kind of a masterpiece of audio design, I think, especially with the binaural 3D sound that you hear through your headphones. It makes all the voices sound like they're constantly like surrounding you or coming in from different sides. Really, really incredible. And it's all very layered and very specific.
You're doing a good job podcasting, Steve. Keep podcasting. Make more witty remarks.
Keep going.
No one likes you.
Comment on your favorite movie, Steve. People want to hear, CJ, people want to hear more Australian colloquialisms. Oh, God.
Thank you. Just going to do that the rest of the podcast.
But obviously the other element here is the visuals. You know, they went to a great deal of trouble with the motion capture here. And we have to talk about the performance of Senua. It's by a woman named Melina Jurgens. Melina Jurgens is not an actress. She'd never acted before this. She is a German photographer and a freelance video editor. And they hired her on to just be a stand-in until they figured out who they were going to cast as Senua down the line. And she
was she part of their media team at the time?
And I believe.
Hey, just come and whack these tennis balls on. We need to point some cameras at a person.
I believe so. Yeah, I think she was living in London at the time when they were making this game, and they just kind of recruited her. And then they thought she did such a great job with it, they just kept her in the game. And she would go on to win like a bunch of awards for this. I think she won like best performance at the Game Awards or something like that. And like, never acted before, but she is remarkable in this performance. Like, really, really tortured moving. And really empathetic, and really, she feels so scared and fragile, but still like has these deep reserves of strength. I think there's so much going on with this character that's really cool, and you empathize with her so much because she is a deeply broken person, you know, on all these, and she's heading out on this quest with the intention of not coming back. Like, she has no delusions heroism or anything. She just wants to do this one last thing. You know,
this is something she must do, and you see that in the performance that comes through in a digital model.
Yeah.
Which is,
I mean,
remarkable.
Speaking of like a digital model, I think that even though I said there's only two main characters in this game, the models of Senua and
Druth is the crazy kind of Irish guy who tells tales of the Norsemen.
Druth's model might be the most photorealistic character model I've ever seen in a video
game. To the point where I thought, like, is this just FMV?
It is overlaid FMV. Druth is, and we're right back to multimedia all coming together and conquering the world, Woody. Druth, and there's a couple of scenes with Senua's mother.
Yeah,
that are FMV overlays, and they just do such a clever piece of camera movement within the world that you barely recognize the camera move. It's almost invisible to you, and they just blend so seamlessly.
Yeah, they really do, and it also kind of helps emphasize like the otherworldliness of everything, you know, because. Mm-hmm. Senua's character model is like very realistic, but it's not like uncanny.
It still
Valley
looks
level.
Like a video game character.
It looks like a video game character. It just looks like a very well rendered one. And these other people come in and they are real people, and it's a nice jarring effect there. So yeah, you know, when this game came out, obviously everyone's praising it as this very important work of art, and everyone's talking about the impact and the experience of it. But the gameplay does tend to kind of get forgotten about, and that's sort of what I wanted to dig into here. There's one big mechanic, and it's kind of the only time that you have any text on screen, and that is that early on, Senua gets infected with like this rot in her arm, and every time that she loses in battle, the infection will creep a little bit further up her arm until it gets to her head, at which point the game warns you that you will die, you will have a permanent death, all of your save progress will be deleted, you'll need to start the game over again. So I played this the first time, like, you know, knowing that and just being like, oh, man, this makes things so intense. I don't know how long, how many deaths I can get. I don't know how any of this will work.
I mean, to be clear, this
how
game
close
is.
Am I to an end?
This game is quite easy.
It's not like, it's not terribly hard.
You're probably not going to die most of the time. But
no, it's true.
It's not clear. Yeah. You're like, I really don't want to lose my save progress, and I don't know how many deaths that takes.
But yeah, exactly.
I also played it with. You know, fearing, I'm wondering, like, how many deaths will it take? But
and, you know, the whole first time I played through it, I never permanently died. I died several times, but it never got to my head. And so I'm like, it was reaching that point where I'm near the end of the game. I'm like, oh, God, what's the point? If I take one more hit, I'm just going to die. I have to start the game over. But that never happened. I was able to beat the game. And it wasn't until researching for this episode that I realized that the permadeath is a lie. This is a fib the Ninja Theory laid on us, or they call it a bluff. I think it's just kind of a lie.
The very specific wording of this warning message is the beginning is, whenever Senua dies, the rot will grow on her arm. If the rot reaches her head, she will die.
Yes.
But specifically, the rot will never grow from her arm to her head.
Yeah,
if it reaches her head.
You're making a very logical leap there that makes sense, but also allows Ninja Theory to kind of weasel their way out.
Like, totally.
He never said that it would cause her to go to her head.
Right.
And then I think there is a story beat later in the game where that happens.
Right. And this kind of drew a little bit of controversy, and I was curious about y'all's take on this, just because some gamers felt like they were just being lied to, you know, which is just never a good feeling. You don't want to feel like a developer is pulling a trick on you anymore. You want a filmmaker to be pulling a trick on you. Like there's a subtle difference between a twist.
You want to feel like you're one step ahead of the trick, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of that, but there's also like you want to trust that the rules that are being laid out are for real. You want to trust that these stakes that you're believing in are real, you know, to the degree that, like, you know, it's a video game. Obviously, it's not going to be real, but it is imparting a sense of stakes that aren't actually there.
I didn't have a problem with it because I think that the combat in this game is very forgiving.
Yeah.
It's adjustable on the difficulty. The default setting is auto, which I think just like if you're doing bad at combat, probably just makes it easier.
Sure.
And so you kind of have to be deliberately kind of trying to like the evade mechanic just makes you invincible when you try to evade things.
Right.
So you can kind of just spam that and it's fairly hard to die. And I don't know. I feel like if this game was a super challenging game and that was kind of the point and they put that warning
and
in
the
there.
Combat mechanic was more focused.
Yeah. Then I would be bitter about it. But since I never felt like dying was that much of a like going to happen very often, I never had a problem with it.
It doesn't feel imminent, does it?
No.
And what a good time to talk about the combat.
Yeah, please.
Different this is from something like an Enslaved or any of their previous action games. So Woody, I think I bounced off this really hard the first time I came to it. I'd just finished off the Tomb Raider reboot, and I was primed and ready for ladies in forests kicking ass and a sword and a jump button and a block
and all kinds of crazy combos that you can level up and
gadgets and new weapons,
gadgets and level up and magic spells. There is none of that.
No,
at all. You have a very limited combat set. To the point where when you pause the game, your move set and all of the instructions for playing the game fit on a single screen.
Yeah, everything's right there.
You know, you don't need to go hunting through a submenu to learn some combo strings. It's right there in front of you, and you don't develop those skills really at all through the course of the game.
No.
You have the same tools available to you at the start as you do at the end with some very, very minor exceptions. I think they give you a bit of a signaling tool for a counter move.
Yeah.
But otherwise it's your development with the tool set and your experience in just kiting those enemies and doing a bit of crowd control in the later stages where it does get quite challenging in moments, but you know, you most people should be able to do a run through with a couple of deaths under their belt.
I actually enjoy the combat in this. It's pretty simple, but it can get a little repetitive, but it's responsive and it works. And like, I like that, you know, they don't give you any on-screen tutorials, so you just have to intuit it, and it feels intuitive. It feels like, okay, square would be my light attack, triangle is my heavy attack, X will make me dodge, circle will make me shove, and then I've got a block. Mm-hmm. And if I block it just right, I'll parry, I'll put them off their guard, and then I can take advantage.
It feels and looks really, really clean.
Yeah.
Like, I think that lack of depth would come into play if this game was either longer or the combat played a bigger role in it.
Yeah.
I wish there was a few more variety of enemies, just because it does feel like when you get into these combat sections, they're just like, all right, now you fight the scarecrow guy.
Yeah.
Now you fight the Viking guy. Now you fight a scarecrow and a Viking guy at the same time.
And then a guy will come in with a shield, you know, and the shield is kind of like the closest this gets to variety in the enemies because you'll need to like kick them before you can attack them and things like that. So
you've got to break down some armament before you can start dealing damage. I think there's a big hammer bloke at some
there
point.
There is. Yeah.
That surprises you. But otherwise there's, I think it's a fair complaint. You know, a lot of people, would bounce off something when, like this, that is such a, limited in scope and desire, you know.
Yeah.
They only want to give you those five guys, but man, they're crafted spectacularly.
Yeah.
And I think by limiting that scope and certainly limiting the time that you spend in this world, I think they've really set themselves up to maybe for a real challenge with the sequel, because this could be a miserable world to spend 20 or 30 hours in.
I mean,
be in such a well place by the end of that.
It's currently like a 5 or 6 hour game. It's very, very short, but it is relentlessly bleak. Like there's really between all of the chatter that you're hearing in your ears and just like the aesthetics of everything and just the way the whole story plays out, it is a very, very dour, serious game, and you can have to kind of like force yourself through it.
In an example of
we're really selling it here people who might want to check it out because it is available on so many platforms.
No, look, it's true.
Definitely should reach out. But
I am recommending this game.
Ultimately, a hopeful message.
It is
bleak. It is a tough playthrough in moments, but you know, ultimately, it's a journey of acceptance.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that the combat specifically is just a thing to be aware of, like that this is not an action game.
It's really not.
So just know that when you're going in, like there is some combat. Don't go expecting like, you know, something from the company that made DMC.
Right.
Don't expect the next Revengeance.
Right.
Senua's Gaiden.
And just an example.
I would play the hell out of that though.
Actually, yeah, I would too.
An example of sort of the bleakness and sort of the way the most of this game is spent solving puzzles, and they're not like box pushing puzzels. They're kind of like mist style visual.
I mean, but
puzzles.
You had to be happy you didn't push a single
box. I was happy to not push the boxes, but like most of the puzzles are triggered by looking at stuff, which is very weird.
Like, well, the game is like the whole theme of the game is around perception, and it's about how Senua sees the world.
Much.
And I think the puzzles and those kind of sections have been built around that idea. So like the two paths that you go on as the game starts, you can choose to either go after Surt, the fire god, or you can go after Valravn, the illusion god. I went after Valravn first this time. And his section is really, really interesting because everything that you're seeing, you can't really trust. And there are these different weird portals that you have to look through and then walk through in order to rematerialize some material. You know, like you'll open up a hole in a wall that you, by walking through this portal that you can't otherwise, you know, or you'll see you'll see a rune that you didn't see otherwise. And so, yeah, so looking and focusing, her ability to focus on things is kind of an important mechanic throughout the game. And but you struggled a bit with this, like as a gameplay
idea. I did. Like all of these mechanics, because the game gives you so little indication on what these sort of puzzle mechanics are basically kind of dependent on you wandering around and trying to find. I never felt a sense of, oh, I understand how this mechanic works. Because like some gates would make a thing appear. Some things gates would make it disappear. The one that really frustrated me is I went after Surt first, who the mechanic on his doors is that they have 1 to 3 runes on the door of like different shapes. And so you'll focus on those and Senua will like embed them in her mind and then they'll kind of hover on screen there. And then you have to walk around this area and find a section of the environment that matches the shape of the rune.
Yeah, it's kind of like look for it naturally occurring. So this isn't a case like, oh, here's the S symbol. I'd better go look for the identical S symbol that's somewhere here in the world. Like it's going to be a glowing button that's going to be very clear.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a matter of force perspective.
Yeah, so you one of them to, was like a three-pronged fork, for example, and all around were these you know, two-pronged trees that had bodies hanging on them.
Sure.
But if you look at one of those trees, it doesn't trigger. So you have to go behind a different tree and set up your perspective so that tree is in the middle of the two-pronged tree, and then it makes the shape. And it was something, I have trouble visualizing things spatially. And so to have to change the perspective that Senua was looking at a thing for it to trigger or not was just a mechanic I found tremendously frustrating. And it's, you know, there's maybe 5 doors that have this.
Yeah.
But I just found very little joy in it. And it felt like kind of a cheaty thing to look up. Eventually, I just...
But when you're in that kind of fruitless space where all you want to do is stop wandering that environment.
Yes.
I just want to find the log that's resting on a rock that's going to make the shape of a fish so I can open this door and get stabbed in the face. It's one of the rough edges that I think you do need to acknowledge about, again, the game that's not much of a game.
Yeah.
But also is a great game in moments. It gives me a lot of hope for what they're going to do with the sequel, with having taken the learnings from the rough edges on the old puzzle mechanics. You know, I'm going to be really interested to see what they can do with that to give us a similar experience where the perception is important.
Yeah.
And I think while also learning from other things that have done it better, there's a game out, Superliminal, I think, which is also all about perception. And that's about a 90-minute to 2-hour playthrough. And that's an example of these kind of in-world perception, interlocking objects puzzle done really, really well with a slightly more powerful engine behind it.
I'm actually a fan of the puzzle mechanics in this. And I think the second time around, I don't know, I didn't really put it together the first time around, that the game leads you by the hand quite a bit when it comes to solving these puzzles. Like, you're not just wandering around forever. When you're near one of these ruins, there'll be like red symbols appearing all over the place. And then as you get closer and closer to where you are, your controller will vibrate and the voices will get a little more frantic. And like, things will pick up a little bit. There'll be indications of where these runes are. So you're not going to be wandering around forever. That helped a lot on my second playthrough. But I agree, I was frustrated with it the first time because it's like, well, any of these could be a triangle. Like,
right,
I don't know.
Why doesn't Senua just pick up some sticks, put them on the ground, and turn them into a triangle, and then, like, look at that?
Because then the voice would be like, that's cheating. You're cheating. You're not doing it right. You're cheating.
And, yeah, I definitely attuned to those clues of, like, oh, as these get more, like, I can tell I'm in the right area. But even so, it was just, it's just sort of mentally, like, the way these puzzles in this game work don't click with the way my brain works for things.
Yeah.
And it's that combination of me personally getting frustrated by the puzzles and then the Senua's incessant mental chatter herself. And it's like, I already have my own mental chatter going on trying to be frustrated about this puzzle.
Right.
You don't need to layer this on top of it. And
it can be pretty bleak having a game tell you you're doing bad at this. Like, yeah, like it's I don't need that.
Yeah, it is the worst. Like when they have like design like ultra challenging games or like retro throwback games where you die and they're like, you suck.
Yeah,
and you're like, okay, game, I'm just gonna stop playing you now.
Well, fine. Like, I'm gonna exactly. go play a game that likes me.
And again, like I think that this game, it's all sort of in a good place and good spirits. I just the heavy reliance on sort of Myst style or The Witness, which is a game I haven't played, but I know that I would hate.
You would hate it. You would hate it deeply.
Style puzzles really, really rubbed me the wrong way and made it hard for me to want to proceed. Because the tone of this game is so heavy, I want the actual gameplay to be smooth and effortless so I can focus on those sort of tonal things. And when I'm getting hung up on the gameplay, I'm just like, I'm just going to give up.
And that's what I'm curious to see.
It makes it really hard to get in to enjoy being punched in the gut by the story when you know you're getting punched in the gut by the game mechanic as well. And there are a couple of moments that are to the game's detriment. You know, that do make it a slog to carry on through it at some points.
And yeah, you know, and I'm defending the gameplay more than most people who play this game. Like But I agree. Like, and CJ, you've mentioned the sequel coming out pretty soon. You know, which was a surprise to me when they announced it a few years ago, because this is not a game screaming out for a sequel. It's a pretty self-contained story. But the next one's gonna be called Senua's Saga: Hellblade 2. And as of June of this year, the team says they're still quite a ways away from finishing it. And it's all we really know is it's gonna take place 100 years later in Iceland. And Melina Jurgens is still playing a character. It's still playing Senua. I don't know how, but it's going to be interesting to see. But I'm curious which way they're going to come down.
Tie it
on
into
it.
The Marvel multiverse.
Oh, good.
There's time travel.
She's gonna be Ulick the troll.
Enter the Senuaverse.
That is a deep cut.
But I mean, I'm curious if they're going to lean more like, you know, this first game is more of an experience than it is a great game. It's like a really important experience, but maybe not like a great gameplay experience. And I'm curious how they're going to balance that out with the next one, because the company has since been acquired by Microsoft. This next game is going to be a Microsoft Studios game. So you have to imagine it's going to be bigger. It's going to be faster. It's going to be a little bit more action oriented.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. I imagine that Microsoft I think Microsoft probably sees value, because this game won a lot of won awards for its writing and for its depiction of mental illness.
And I think Ninja Theory's biggest commercial success too.
Yeah. And I think Microsoft, aside from commercial success, I'm sure they see value in a game that can be easily perceived as art easily perceived as being, you know, respectful of exploring these issues that most games don't explore.
And certainly not respectfully if they do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To just have released and published a game like that. That's like a, you know, Microsoft has got money to burn. So even if the game...
Literally, they have a whole division of just money burning.
Yeah, exactly, the money-burning division.
The furnace with 30 people working shovels. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And so I think it wouldn't surprise me if the sequel leans into just as much of the weird stuff that makes this game so unique.
I hope so. I hope so.
I think you're right. Yeah. And when you've got a footprint like Microsoft, when you've got a Game Pass library that you're working to grow all the time... you don't necessarily just want the first person shooter guys, because they're gonna glom onto one game and stick with that thing for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
If you want to provide a gaming ecosystem, you want to give something for everyone. You want to give something that's a more traditional run and gun type experience. You might want to give something that's a little more evolved, requires a bit more work, maybe.
Yeah.
And isn't for everyone, and that's okay.
I'll
be really interested to see what they do with the being able to more easily transform a world. You know, things that you couldn't so easily do in the older tools, the next gen tools, and some of this faster silicon. I'm really excited to see what they can do to make me feel really uncomfortable and miserable again.
Yeah. I mean, this thing is going to pop on next-gen systems. You know, there was, like we mentioned that this is on Switch and Xbox Series X right now, and the Series X version has been completely revamped and, like, remastered, and it looks really, really good.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah.
It's a shame that with the acquisition, I doubt we're going to see a PS5
I doubt it.
Because it could be done.
At least not at first. Yeah, it might be a little bit, but yeah.
It's just landed on PC as well. So if you've got the hardware to do that, you can crank the ray tracing slider all the way.
Perfect.
And run it in as many frames as you like.
Great. Oh, awesome.
Everybody loves ray tracing.
That's me. That was my chiropractor. Yeah, ray tracing is really good. It's really good. Yeah. Well, that's all I've got on Hellblade. CJ, do you have anything else you wanted to say about the game before we wrap up here?
Look, it can be challenging. It's fairly short. It's the kind of thing that I would encourage anyone that has an interest in gaming or even film to pick up and take a look at. This is the kind of cinematic gaming experience that, you know, I remember being a young fella and seeing Dragon's Lair. Running in an arcade.
Yeah.
Just assuming that we had reached the nadir, the apex.
The apex, yeah. There you go.
The cinematic and gaming experience.
That's so similar. Well, just real quick. Such a similar experience to what my mom and dad had, because like they brought my brother to an arcade and were like, wow, this game looks amazing. And then, but they had no idea what the gameplay mechanics were, because they just saw the screen. And
which
then
is a DVD remote.
Every other game, they're like, why doesn't this look as good as Dragon's Lair? And it's like, well, this one is actually a game you can play.
It is fun and enjoyable.
Yeah, exactly. So sorry, I interrupted CJ, but like...
No, but isn't that the truth? You know, that's how we were limited in technology that allowed... our storytelling back then, well, we were just streaming at 20 frames off a Laserdisc.
Yeah.
Today, we can create these moving, disturbing and uplifting experiences in real time on our telephones. We're truly living in Star Trek. So if you've got an interest in a good moving story that isn't a GTA remix, this is one of the games that a lot of people might have slept on.
It's
super available. It's on Game Pass if you have a PC or Xbox and have access to that service. So you should do yourself a favor and check it out.
Definitely. Yeah. I agree. I mean, you know, we've been criticizing some of the gameplay elements a little bit just because we do have to take this as a whole, but like as an experience and as a, an example of something that this medium can do better than maybe any other medium, it's very impressive. And I think you're going to walk away from this game feeling much more empathetic towards people who are struggling with issues like this and, you know, feeling like you really kind of been transported somewhere. And I think that's not nothing, you know, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. And look, definitely throw some headphones on
yes.
before you get into this. The binaural effects of things like the voices and the direction, even the conversations with Druth, are excellent, but the score, which we haven't touched on.
Oh, yeah.
Really is just tremendous.
Yeah.
It's a really, really moving piece of work.
No, it absolutely is. Well, CJ, thank you so, so much for being here. Do you have anything you'd like
thank
to plug? Anything you'd like to tell people about?
Besides Senua.
Not at all. Mm-hmm.
Well,
did you guys know, if you want to be really happy, guys, as maybe an antidote to this, you could go and have a look at maybe play some rain on your parade if you need need an anti-Senua.
Okay.
And just maybe squirt some cheese whiz just directly into your mouths. And, you know, just be good to one another. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
You want to plug the concept of kindness.
Yeah.
kindness and just cheese product.
I can support that. I think we can all support that.
Another good pub trivia name, Kindness and Cheese Whiz.
Yes, yes. I love it. That's really good. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. You can find us at ultra64podcast@gmail.com. If you want to send us an email, go to patreon.com/ultra64pod. If you want to find hundreds of episodes, more than 100 at this point, not hundreds, but more than 100 bonus episodes.
Easily.
Lots and lots and lots of content, more coming every single week.
If you want to be a cool guy like CJ,
yeah.
you can join on that top tier and make us play something else.
Absolutely.
That
absolutely.
Is what people say.
All of our guests have been incredibly kind about what they've made us play so far. So I'm excited to continue doing so. All right, everybody. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.